So we welcome back, Ron Ruth, recently retired campus pastor from the University of Arizona, and in good his sessions and living work. So thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Sharon. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear this okay?
Good morning.
Seem to be on?
Yes.
Great to be with you. This is session three. As Sharon said, I just recently retired from campus ministry at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And here this week with my wife, Nancy. Wave your hand, Nancy. She's knitting back there. And she's retiring this month from Habitat for Humanity. Been there for the last 17 years. And we're here with our daughter and daughter-in-law, our daughter, Jen, in the back there. She's the campus pastor at Pacific Lutheran University, which is down the road in Tacoma. And her spouse, Deb, is a librarian at a local public library in Port Orchard, just outside of Tacoma. So we're having a great week together, too. We played Yahtzee last night. We played a new game that I had no clue. I had no clue what I was doing, what the purpose was, what the goal was, but I won the first game.
It's all downhill from there.
Yes.
I lost the first game.
So it's great to be here. The title of this class is God's Story of Life, God's Story of Jesus. The areas that I seem to be interested in this time in my life are the natural sciences, especially astronomy and geology and evolutionary biology and paleoanthropology, which is kind of our predecessor species, Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and about 13 others. And then interested in Christian theology, of course, and how both of those affect sustainability. So this class is kind of a weaving together of those things. My first part of my life, I was into the humanities, I would say. But the last 20 years or so, I've really become interested in the natural sciences. And I wondered how our understanding of the Christian story might even be changed a little bit as we take the natural sciences a little more seriously, what has been learned about this universe, especially in the last 500 years. So that's kind of the journey I'm on, and I found myself thinking about things differently than I did even 10, 15 years ago. That's a little bit about what we're about today. So let me just review what we've talked about the first 2 days, because I know some people are just popping in on this story. And you see, Monday, we talked about God's ancient and vast universe and trying to get a sense that, boy, this is a big place. And this story, God's story, has been going on for a long time, 13.7 billion years. That's how long God has been creating and engaging and inspiring and loving and forgiving and interacting and sometimes intervening, sometimes pulling back. And for the first 9 billion years, our planet wasn't even here. So there's a lot of God's story that doesn't even include us. And then when we think about life starting about 3.8 billion years ago and multiple cell life about 660 million years ago, and life moved on to land about 395 million years ago, and reptiles and dinosaurs seem to be around about 295 million years ago, and small mammals a couple hundred million years ago, and larger mammals 60 million years ago. And we, Homo sapiens, have only been around here about 200,000 years, which may seem like a lot of time, but it's pretty small. If we were to take on our laptop and push the hyphen button, and each time we pushed it, it was 200,000 years, we would have to push it 19,000 times for us to have how long life has been thriving on this planet. And we've been there for one of those hyphens, and who knows if we'll be here for the next one. But, you know, why did God make this world so big? And It can make us feel small. And for some people, that's disturbing. I guess for me, I don't find that disturbing, my smallness. I feel kind of privileged to be invited into a pretty large story. Yesterday, we looked at this thing called sin and tried to look at what that might be. And I suggested a theory that, again, you don't have to buy. You may be intrigued by it. You may have been thinking about this already, or you may listen to it and say, that guy is nuts. That's okay. But what is this all about? And I suggested that the reason that Judaism and Christianity are such recent religions, they're modern, brand new baby religions. They've only been around. Dr. Ed Wright, who's the head of our Judaic Studies Department at the University of Arizona, says prior to about 3,500 years ago, there's really no evidence of anything having to do with, you know, the Hebrews or Israel or Torah or Judaism or Moses or any of that kind of thing. And then, of course, Christianity, a couple thousand years. These are modern religions. And I suggested that what prompted these religions, God's acting, was a recent regression as a species. We started to regress. After a couple hundred thousand years of living fairly well in God's creation, we started to go awry. And not so much in terms of smarts. We're plenty smart. But in terms of intelligence, and certainly in terms of wisdom. And I suggested that smarts is the ability to get what you want. A lot of people know how to do that. Intelligence is being able to think on multiple layers, to understand nuance, to see other perspectives outside your own. And of course, wisdom has to do with thinking of the bigger picture, long-term ethics. And this regression sort of is what kind of prompted these new modern religions. And I suggested that at the core of this regression was a change in worldview that started to take hold in our species. And that change in worldview was, rather than seeing ourselves as a part of God's creation, we started to see ourselves as separate from, superior to. The reason for, yeah, these first 13.7 billion years was just getting ready for us. And the rulers of. We exchanged the narrative that said, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And we, along with 20 other million species in this particular planet, have been invited to be a part of that. We exchanged that narrative to the earth belongs to humans. Every square foot, it's for us. And four things to say about that narrative. No other species concurs. I also would suggest that's a recent narrative in our species. If you think of indigenous peoples and tens of thousands of cultures around the planet, and some were high-centered, but I think generally we could say that most kind of saw themselves as a part of creation. But recently, I think a new narrative has gained footing and now is dominant in our species. And that is that this place belongs to us. We certainly behave as though that's the case. And I would suggest, in sort of being self-critical as a Christian, I think Christianity, in many ways, has been the keeper of this false narrative. And I think as Christians, we're doing as much damage to God's creation as anyone. And maybe we haven't understood our own story as deeply as we might. And then the fourth thing to say about this, I think this new narrative has a lot to do with us living in a way that is unsustainable and seem to be tooled to continue that way. And kind of my overall thesis is, as long as we have this narrative, and all of us have been marinated in our mother's womb with this narrative, that the earth belongs to humans. As long as we have that, we will continue to behave poorly. So my life calling in earth, on earth is to change the narrative of the whole Christian church.
Good luck.
And, and if we can be converted to following Jesus, maybe we can become like the chosen people of Israel. They were meant to learn how to live so that they could help to teach the rest of their species how to live. I suggested that some of these early stories in the Bible are trying to wrestle with this. You can imagine these writers here and storytellers kind of noticing this new narrative coming into their community, or maybe arising from their community, and sort of scratching their heads and going, what's wrong with these people? They seem to, I don't know, they seem to think the world belongs to our species. What's going on there? Well, maybe, I'm making a parable, maybe they ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and they think they're godlike. Maybe that's what the problem is. Or, in this story, maybe they think the goal in life, rather than sort of reveling in our smallness, maybe the goal in life is to loom large and to make a name for ourselves, to be great. And Daniel Quinn, I don't know if you've read any of his stuff, he kind of talks about this story, and this is sort of a template that I kind of use. Abel, as you recall, God was pleased with Abel. Not only his offerings, I don't think, but also the way he got his wealth to be able to share. And Abel, and Cain comes on the scene, and what does Cain do? Cain rises up and kills Abel. And that's sort of the story of the last few thousand years. Whenever Cain finds Abel, Cain rises up to kill him. And you might think of Abel as kind of maybe indigenous cultures. Not that they were saints or angels or perfect or anything like that, but they tended to live more as part of God's creation. But Cain, whenever Cain finds them, he rises up to destroy their language, to destroy their culture, to destroy their food sources, and eventually to commit genocide, which many nations have done, including the United States of America. But kind of keep that template in your mind, Cain and Abel. And I'm suggesting that Abel is the way that God calls us to live. And Cain is an aberrant narrative that has recently infected our species and is part of what is harming the rest of God's creation. In fact, I would even suggest that Western civilization has turned Abel of Nazareth into Cain of Nazareth. I also suggested yesterday that there are really two scriptures. So sola scriptura, I know this is heresy. I think we read God's voice in the scriptures of nature, in atoms and stardust, in geological layers and tree rings and ice cap layers and DNA. This is a story that every single ecosystem and creature in the universe reads in their own language, including humans. And then there's a secondary, more recent scriptures that's not too old, 3,000 years. That's really just addressed to our species only, and we're probably the only ones that read the Bible. But it's addressed to us, and it's about us, and it's for us, because God has a secondary mission. In addition to his or her primary mission, God has decided to try to fix one particular species that's gone off course and restore us to God's primary mission. And that's maybe what the biblical story is about. God has decided to try to heal us from anthropocentrism, from diva theology, thinking that we're the divas of the world, and from what I call, and maybe this isn't the right word, Deb and I were having some good conversation about this, what I mean by humanism is not how it's usually thought of as sort of, you know, appreciating the dignity of humanity, but I kind of use that as a as putting ourselves central and on top and thinking that we're God's primary obsession. And I think that's what God is trying to heal. Another way to talk about it is I-centeredness. As a species, as a nation, as an individual, isn't that kind of the definition of sin? I-centeredness, or turning in on self. Luther talked about that. That takes many forms. And that I-centeredness throws us out of relationship with our neighbor, with nature, with our own inner soul and spirit and self, and of course with God. So, God has decided to try to heal us. I think the rest of creation is kind of glad about that. And certainly we're glad about that. Rather than this narrative, we've fallen into this narrative. Rather than being people who are what Daniel Quinn calls leavers, you take what's needed and leave the rest. We become takers who take and take and take and take. And don't know how to stop. What do you mean, leave? Cain thinks. Why would I only just take what I need when I can take more? Really, the problem is we have ceased raising Abel. You know, instead of raising Cain. In our schools, in our families, in our churches. We're teaching Cain how to survive in a Cain world, in a way. But it's a pathway that is, it's unsustainable. It's going nowhere. But there's good news. God has decided to try to heal us. And that's what the Old Testament and New Testament are about. That's what we're going to look at today. How? After Genesis 6:6, where it says God was sorry he had made the human creature, and it grieved God to God's heart. God apparently decided not to destroy us for the sake of the world, but to try to heal us and bring us back into the household. And that's really what the biblical story is about. So we're going to look at a big sweep of the biblical story today, God's secondary mission. But before we do that, let's pray.
Lord, gather us in prayer. You rule the nations. Guide citizens in all countries, including your own. Convert leaders in the direction of wisdom and integrity. However, when our leaders choose wayward paths, give Christians and others the courage to speak out, resist, undermine, sabotage, and work for the failures of those wayward ways. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So, let's look at the Old Testament, kind of some ways that God jumped in to try to heal our species. There's Noah in the flood parable. Notice that I call it a parable rather than something that's historical. And I do that for two reasons. First of all, in terms of the natural sciences, there never was a time when there were floods so great that it covered all the mountains on this planet, including Mount Ararat in Turkey, which is 16,000 feet, let alone Mount Everest, Nepal and Tibet, which is 29,000 feet. By 15 cubits, that never really happened, especially when humans were around. So scientifically, so that's one reason I think this is a parable rather than history. Certainly there were floods. There were floods all over, and it can seem devastating to the people who are living in the particular area. But in terms of covering the earth, as the Bible says, I don't think that happened. But the second reason that I see this as a parable is theological. I think if we see this as something that happened, that God did, we have to believe in a God of genocide. And I kind of choose not to do that. I choose not to believe in a God who seems more in line with a Nazi death camp. Anybody been to, I took our students to Buchenwald.
Yeah.
Where have you been?
Dachau.
Yeah.
Buchenwald.
Yeah. So, a parable. And so if it's a parable, you always ask, parables have a point or a message. What might be the message? And maybe the message is, folks, if you think you can get rid of evil by killing off a bunch of evil people, think again. It turns out that Noah and his family sort of picked up the slack pretty quickly. Maybe this is a parable to show how God is not going to try and heal Cain. That's a thought that I would suggest to think about. God tried a chosen people. Well, where do you find a chosen people anyway?
Here?
Yeah, right. This is a graphic from Daniel Erlander's wonderful book, Manna and Mercy. I'm sure you read it, only I tweaked it a little bit. This is sort of a graphic in, so God went to Pharaoh's Egypt. And incidentally, Pharaoh's Egypt is shaped like a pyramid. At the top you have political classes, the wealthy. You have then landowners, a few more. Then you have farmers, trades, professions. Then you have slave labor, or those who worked for slave wages. Then you have the surrounding poor nations where you extract resources, including cheap labor. And then at the bottom of the pyramid, the least that you care about is the rest of the community of life. And the keepers of this system, of course, are the military, who use their weapons to protect this, who use war and the threat of war and the appearance of the threat of war to protect that. And, of course, you have religion. And religion likes to say that this is God's system. So, God went to this system, Pharaoh's Egypt, to look for a chosen people. If you were looking for a chosen people, where would you look on this pyramid? He looked at some slaves. And as Daniel Erlander says, freed them and sent them into the desert for 40 years of wilderness school. To learn again how to live. So that they could then teach the rest of their species how to live. And it's important to realize that God did not set these folks free in order for them to be free. Freedom can be a false god, just like anything. And many nations, including ours, have committed horrific atrocities in the name of freedom. God set them to be free in order to learn a new way of living. Let's call that the Able Way. And then to teach others. Would someone like to read this from Isaiah? Just jump forth here.
I will.
Yep.
In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of mountains, and shall be raised above the hills. All nations shall stream to it. Many peoples shall say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways of being in the world, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Israel. Jerusalem. Sorry.
Yeah.
Jerusalem.
But too often, the chosen people saw their chosenness as special status rather than special service. I wonder if that happens to Christians sometimes. God tried laws. We need laws. Laws are good. But laws don't necessarily heal us. Because you can obey every law and be kind of a rotten person on the inside. There's an old story that pastors, preachers used to use as sermon illustrations about a family that had three kids, and mom and dad had to go into town and get groceries, so they left the three kids at home. And the only instruction was, whatever you do, don't put a penny up your nose. So they went into town, got the groceries, came back home. Sure enough, one of the kids had a penny up her nose. Another one had a nickel up his nose, saying, you just said we couldn't put a penny up there. And then the third one was feeling self-righteous because they did neither. Laws are necessary, but they can tend to trigger other perverse things in ourselves. Promised land. I don't know. I've been thinking, did God give the promised land, the land of Canaan? I wonder. He may have invited them into that land to live amongst the people who already live there. But if you read Joshua and Judges, you find a God who tells people to take other people's land and to murder people and to burn villages and to dash babies against walls and to act as though that you deserve this land and everyone else get out. I wonder if some military propaganda made it into the Bible. We're going to talk more about kind of violence in the Bible tomorrow, a little bit. But I'm not so sure that this is the promised land. And we can see how that has affected things even today. I know this is too late to have it happen, but wouldn't it have been wonderful if after World War II, instead of taking away the land from the Palestinians and giving it to the people who had suffered so much in the Holocaust, what if they would have divided Germany in half and given the best part to the state of Israel? And that's going to be your homeland now. How would life be a little different now?
Well, it did divide Germany in half.
Well, that too. Yeah. If they could have gotten together, Russia or Soviets and the West, yeah. But anyway, I think people tended to take this as God's promise when they were trying to establish the state of Israel. And the world community was operating out of that narrative. God had given this land to these people. So, it's very touchy, and I'm sure a Jewish person would be very offended by what I just said, and because they have been, the Holocaust is just so terrible, and other things through history. But the Palestinians didn't do the Holocaust. God tried kings. We have to remember that the idea of kings was not God's idea. It was like, you remember that the people of Israel came to Samuel, who was sort of the chaplain of the nation, and said, we want a king. And Samuel said, no, you don't. And they said, yeah, we do. Why do you want a king? Well, we look at our neighbors. They have kings. They seem to have more wealth, stronger military, more material appliances. We want to have a king. Samuel said, no, no you don't. Samuel went to the Lord and said, yikes! They want a king, what do I do? They're rejecting me. And Yahweh says, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Well, let's read then what Samuel said to the people of Israel when God finally went along with having a king. And basically this passage says, do you realize what you're getting into? Would someone like to read this?
Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king. He said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties and some to plow his ground and reap his harvest. and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take 1/10 of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take 1/10 of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day.
Now we need to know that within the scriptures there are some pro-king passages and some anti-king passages. They're both in the Bible, right? This would be kind of an anti-king passage. But God went along with it. So the first king was Saul, who started out pretty well. Pretty soon was rotten to the core. Then came David, who started out pretty well, but went astray in many ways. The story of David raping Bathsheba, and then murdering her husband, in a way is a story of sort of personal failure on David's part, but it's also a story of how Cain behaves in this world and how Cain cultures behave in this world. Now, some may be offended by the word rape, but if you're the king and you call someone to your bedroom and within a few minutes you're having sex with that person, that doesn't seem like a consensual. Even though if you go on Google Images and look for images of that story, you almost see that Sheba is a seductress. Why is that?
The woman made me do it.
Yeah. And Solomon, too, started out pretty good when he was a young boy. He had this beautiful prayer. He prayed for wisdom, that he would be an honorable king. But he soon was rotten to the core, too. He engaged in concupiscence. I love that word. Anybody know what that word means, concupiscence? It means gather all things unto myself. He terrorized neighboring nations and extracted their resources, including cheap labor. And he built a temple supposedly to the Lord with people he had enslaved. Well, what could be more contrary to God? Or to a temple to God? So within a short time of 100 years, King Solomon had become just another Pharaoh and Israel just another Egypt. And God tried prophets who spoke words of warning and hope, who spoke truth. Prophets, as we know in the Bible, are not people who see the future. They're people who see the present only more deeply than the rest of us are seeing and know what's really going on. And if we continue this, yeah, then these things will probably happen. And God sent many other Abels too over the years in the form of rabbis, prophets, wise people, indigenous people, people on the margins, and even the wider community of life. The sound of the still small voice or the sound of sheer silence. Are we listening? Is there anything left? What will God decide to do? Well, finally, God decided to come in person. But God could not come in person because God is too big, too awesome, too overwhelming. Every creature would have a heart attack, an acute myocardial infarction. So, as Paul kind of puts in poetry and hymnody in Philippians 2, God emptied self of self and very God, and became a placental mammal of the species Homo sapiens. Became a human. Why did God become a human? God's not human. Just like God's not a deer or a bear. Well, it was the human creature that was lost. And the Christ of God came to seek and to save the lost. With a message. An embodied message, not just vocalized, but embodied message. Message to our species. Homo sapiens, you are forgiven. I forgive you, and I forgive you today, and I forgive you tomorrow. I'm going to forgive you the next day, and 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 the next day. Homo sapiens, you are forgiven. But this is not the gospel. God doesn't say, you know, you're messing up my world, but I forgive you. Now go write a bunch of praise songs and liturgies telling me how wonderful you think that I forgive you. You're messing up my world. No, God also says, follow me. Not just follow me, as opposed to following other things, but follow me, as opposed to staying where you are. Come with me. Well, come with you where, Jesus? Follow you where? Well, follow me. I want you to meet your neighbor. And of course, Jesus had to go and tell us that my neighbor is not just people I like or people like me, but my neighbor is the stranger and the strange one, the outcast, the alien, the illegal alien. My neighbor is even my enemy. Yikes, follow me. I took our students to Agua Prieta several times, which is a border town in Mexico, south of Arizona. And there was a Presbyterian program, a border immersion experience, and we would go in the desert. And we came across a group of about 20 people from Honduras, that was getting ready to cross. And we talked with them, and some of our students knew Spanish, so we could talk with them. And they were sort of hiding out in a gully there. And all of a sudden, I heard one of our students kind of say out loud, "My grandma's name is Evelyn." Well, she just talked to a young girl whose name was Evelyn. So maybe Jesus had said to Erica, this student of ours, "Follow me, Erica. I want you to meet your neighbor." Maybe that's why she went on that trip. When we took students to Haiti, and some of you maybe have been to Haiti, we spent a morning at Mother Teresa's baby hospital holding babies and toddlers who were sick. Some would get better, some would not. Some had family, some would not. Some were listless in our arms, some clung to us. So it's those kind of transformative experiences. If we could picture Jesus kind of walking the earth today, the risen Christ, saying, what's your name?
Z.
Z?
Just the letter Z.
Z. Z, follow me. I want you to meet your neighbor. This crazy person here, or this person that you don't like.
You know me well.
Right, no. Follow me. For the last 10 years, Monday mornings, I gave haircuts to homeless men, about 10 on a Monday morning, and I think about 4,000 over the last 10 years. So maybe God was saying, "Ron, follow me. I want you to meet your neighbor." Some of you have other experiences. Maybe there's someone in your neighborhood who you get groceries for because they're having dementia and can't do things anymore. Or maybe you volunteer here and there. I think God is calling every single one of us in a different way. Follow me. I want you to meet your neighbor. And as Daniel Erlander says, the goal is that all have enough and none too much, because to not have enough is deadly, and to have too much is deadly. And follow me, I want you to meet my creation. Homo sapiens, you're not doing too well. Homo sapiens, you're you're showing disregard to my world. Follow me. Maybe that's why we're all here at Holden Village this week. Follow me. I want you to meet my community of life. I forget who said this, but it talked about something called a nature deficit disorder. Who said that? Anybody know? Who?
His first name is Richard.
Yeah. So rather than spending, we always talk about human community. I don't know. Maybe we have enough of that. We need to have community with the rest of the community of life. Rather than spending maybe 95% of my time with humans and 5 with another 20 million species, maybe it should be more, 60-40 or something, I don't know. Maybe we would be saner, maybe, as a species. I used to visit a nursing home in Buffalo, New York, that instead of TV sets all over, television screens, they had fish aquariums. And people would sit and watch. Doesn't that seem a little healthier than to watch daytime TV? And, again, from Daniel Quinn, take what is needed, leave the rest. I go on a fishing trip every year with a friend of mine in Idaho. We hike into a different mountain lake each day and fish for trout, about this big trout. Sometimes we're the first people who have come to this lake that summer, and the fish bite on every single cast. And there's a real temptation to take and take and take and take and take. Luckily, there's a limit, so you can't do that. But I see, Ron, you're a cane. You're a taker. You just, that's in you. And follow me. I want you to even meet your own inner soul and spirit and self. Ron, you're out of connection with your own, with that baptized child in you. You are living a life that has produced emptiness, and then you go around trying to fill it with all kinds of nonsense. Ron, you even need to follow me to meet Ron. And follow me, you need to meet my mother, my father, your mother, your father, your creator. Follow me. So the risen Christ walking the earth today, following each of us. Come with me. Follow me. I want to put you in harm's way and have you experience something that's going to transform you. And it's not just a one-time thing, it's ongoing. Yeah. Jesus says, follow me, Homo sapiens, back into the Creator's household, where dwells your neighbor in creation and your inner soul even, and of course the Creator. These might be the 4 church committees that we should have. Community service, garbology, hiking, spiritual direction, worship, they kind of all fall under maybe those categories. Would someone read this from Ephesians?
For he, Jesus, is our peace, breaking down the dividing wall of hostility, that he might create in himself a new humanity. He came and proclaimed peace to those far off and those near. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but citizens of the household of God.
Good news. Okay, let's just stop there. And what are some insights and thoughts and questions that are kind of rolling around in your mind? Yes?
So it makes me think of Holden Village, of course, because I think about Holden Village every day. But one of the things that we consciously try to do is, and we kind of call it the disciplined pursuit of less, is like live a different way on the planet. And we practice that. And that's why coming to Holden Village is sometimes so important, is because we don't have the opportunity always to actually practice those things in our busy world where we live close to the earth and we do with less and we have a more fulfilling life with less. So there's very few places to practice that on the planet.
Holy Village is an able community in a Cain world.
Well, that's why I think operations and then the newer thing and then the composting. Everybody should go on there.
Yeah, it's really good.
That should be optional. That's the engine that runs the theory.
I'm living with that.
In some sense, it seems that your timeline and progression, I guess, or movement of descent into sin also matches the movement of the rise of civilization. Is there some correlation in there? And it occurs to me that some years ago there was a perspective of the noble savage.
Yeah. We don't want to say Cain is noble or perfect or anything like that. Cain had wars too.
Abel.
And Abel had wars too. Abel, but it was more of a worldview. And I think if you have an Abel worldview, you still have decisions to make. And people will disagree on how you implement that too. That has to be hashed out. But if I'm wearing an Abel hat, that's one thing. But if I'm wearing a Cain hat, I will always make decisions in a certain way. It will be human-centric. And the rise of civilizations. I suppose there's something about when there's greater populations, you organize yourself differently. But I think there are able cultures still going on today. And there are individuals who are ables that are trying to live in a Cain culture. And I think the first step has to do with narrative. What narrative am I going to wake up to and take on to each morning? And as a community tries to make decisions, am I wearing an able hat or a Cain hat? And I think the dominant narrative of our species right now is Cain. And we're not the only culture that's a Cain culture. But I don't know that that's, of the 200,000 years that our species has been here, that that's always been the dominant narrative. I think it's a recent aberration. Yes?
One of the things that occurs to me is that this view allows for the seeds of redemption to live in Judaism and in Christianity, and doesn't assume Christianity is the right path or the right or the fulfillment of Judaism or those things that we have often been taught, but that the stories of God trying to rescue the Hebrew people, there's enough in those stories for the Hebrew people to rescue themselves, so to speak, without becoming Christians.
Right.
I appreciate that.
The world doesn't need any more Christians. There's plenty of us.
Now that's yours.
What the world needs is more people who follow Jesus.
Seriously. And that's a political statement.
Which is?
What you just said.
Say more.
But it's political. Christianity or Christians have been usurped. It's now a political movement.
Ah.
And I don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I don't, at this point, I feel bad about calling myself a Christian based on the politics that's going on.
Yeah. Yes.
They hijack.
Yeah.
Jesus was crucified because of politics. That's something I learned in Holden years ago.
Yeah.
We're always into the politics. Mm-hmm.
It's just worse now. It's very much worse now.
The other thing I think is interesting, I remember being in a class where they talked about, you know, different cultures, and that, you know, our Western culture is very self-centered. You know, it's you know, me first, and whereas historically, Eastern cultures are more community-centered. Mm-hmm. You know, you gave up your individual rights for the better of the community. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, now as we've spread Western ideals, then you end up in these conflicts, mm-hmm. you know, in communities historically that have, you know, seen the community's survival and well-being primary, and the individual's needs, rights, mm-hmm. desires being a secondary thing. But we're so much more conscious of everybody now. You know, there isn't a culture, and there isn't a way of thinking that we are not allowed to be aware of now because we are so interconnected. So even small communities, you know, Hutterites that might live in some section of the United States, there will be an article in the Atlantic, there'll be a story in National Geographic, and all of a sudden you'll be aware of their specific needs, their culture, you know, what they value, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's somebody else we have to try to work with. Mm-hmm. Or even within the Lutheran Church, the three different synods, mm-hmm. you know, how striking that is within those who call themselves Lutherans. And you go, well, I'm not those Lutherans, I'm this Lutheran. Which are a lot nicer, of course, than those Lutherans over there. You know, I mean, we struggle always with who we are, just yeah. our identity, yeah. whether even Christian or not.
One thing that occurred to me today as you were kind of going through this, that we've been around 200,000 years in this kind of form, and that this is a recent thing. There's actually, maybe this is too optimistic, but some hope in that, mm-hmm. in the sense of like deep within us, we know that there's a different way to live, and we maybe even have kernels of how to do it, how to follow in a different way, which I find hopeful. And then I think about even our practices, like I'm thinking about communion specifically, that's a remembrance. Like, remember, do this in remembrance of me. This idea of we need to remember how to live, but it's in us. So, I don't know. That feels hopeful.
The Amish have a three-strand cord. The first cord is the narrative, and that's what I've been kind of talking about here. The second chord are practicing that narrative. And then the third chord has to do with affections. As you change your narrative, as you practice that narrative, your affections start to change. And you're no longer as titillated by Cain. And you find yourself really drawn towards Abel. Yes.
I'm going to be a little bit of a Debbie Downer. I mean, I loved what you had to say. It was just so, I don't know, really hit my heart. But I do think that this idea that Bryan Stevenson, I don't know if people read the book Just Mercy, talks about being proximate to people who are different than you. So you've mentioned that we get to know our neighbors. So recently we moved intentionally to a kind of a, I would say a poor neighborhood. with other people, and I think my hope, it's been really hard for me to live next to people who are very different than me, but we did it with a community in mind, and I think that's hopeful for me, is that there's this community of others who feel the same way, and I think that that is how we're all going to make a difference in the world, is to live proximate to people who are different, but do it in community who, you know, really believe that this is how we are called to live. But it's hard.
It's hard.
I mean, it's one thing to go away to some foreign country, come back to your nice little house and think, I'm following God. And I think we are.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think we are called to do much more than that if we want to fix the problems in America.
Yeah. So maybe the risen Christ said, what's your first name?
Cynthia,
follow me.
Yeah. I mean, I really did feel a call in many ways. But it's hard.
Right. And then you become a teacher to us.
I'm not there yet.
And not that you're, okay, I did this and I know how to do it, you would share the struggle.
Right.
Versus teaching. Yeah.
But it seems like we're never there.
No.
We have been flowing in and out of it because we're human.
Right,
and
we are.
Continually fail and keep trying, and that's why you come back here once a year to recharge.
Exactly. Yeah, we all have some of Cain in us.
That's right, we all have Cain in us. And we all have, but it's, and maybe the doctrine of original sin, I found myself thinking of this differently. It almost kind of makes it seem that I am destined to be destructive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I certainly have destructive tendencies, but I also have constructive tendencies in me. And in community, I can be transformed, too. So while destruction is in my nature, I don't think it's the totality of my nature. So, yes?
Going back to the Amish, they also have, you have your Mormons with their two-year mission, but with the Amish, they have the kids go out and live in the world and then choose to come back, as opposed to being corralled.
Yeah.
So
let's say, as a generalization, the Amish are an able community. Yeah, they said, okay, part of your learning here, you're going to go out and live in the Cain world and see that. You may be kind of titillated by a few things, and we want you to explore that. And some probably stay there, huh? And some come back. But again, Amish are not perfect angels, or they have sins in all of us. But I think they're wearing a different hat than we're wearing. Okay, it's time to wrap up with someone. Tomorrow we're going to take a look at the Reformation, and I'm going to suggest that it might be time for a new Reformation. Would someone like to take the L part here in this closing benediction?
Go in peace into nature and human community.
Hold fast to what is good, return evil to no one.
Make common cause with those who are oppressed.
Respect the scope of God's creation, always working honorably within nature's multi-layered ecosystems and species diversities.
Cherish life, but don't hoard life.
Above all, love the one who bestows every blessing.
May the peace of God, world maker, pain maker, and love giver be upon us all.
Amen.